I'm Laura Smale, and I'm talking to Walter Rideout, who is in the English department at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. Professor Rideout, there's been a lot of talk about research by college professors, why they do it, whether it's useful, whether it interferes with their teaching. So I'd like you to talk about your research, what you're doing, and how you got into it, and what you see its value as being.
Okay. Perhaps I should make a comment first about research in general and its relation to teaching. There are two points that ought to be made. One is that if you are actively involved in extending knowledge, you tend to pass on either that specific knowledge or techniques of getting knowledge to your students so that you are aware of new things that are happening. You learn to use a tape recorder, for example. You learn how to use computers if you're getting involved in numerical or mensory kind of research, so that you have a direct classroom effect, which I think lends an excitement to the whole adventure of learning. And students should know about this. It tends to turn them on to education more than simply sitting there and getting a compilation of facts. Second thing is, and this is very frequently overlooked, research in general, published research, is a mode of teaching in itself. If one publishes a biography, let us say, of Sherwood Anderson, which I'm working on, my hope would be that many other people around the country would read it. My hope would be that roughly 210 million people would read it, but that's asking for too much. But a lot of people would read it, not necessarily just scholars or people interested in 20th century literature, but people who might want to know how it was to grow up in the late 19th century, early 20th century, at a time when there were no proved routes for a writer to become a writer, and to find out what their past was like as a result, how suddenly a businessman, a person who essentially was a businessman, decided that he would like to communicate ideas that were non-business ideas. Then this would get across as a mode of external to the campus teaching. Furthermore, a book like this would be used by other college professors who would want to use it as a way of getting a more accurate picture of what the development of American fiction was. So I think of research as simply another mode of teaching and an absolutely essential one. I don't accept the notion that you must publish or perish. I would say rather that you have to publish or intellectually stagnate.
Why did you pick on Sherwood Anderson to write about?
It was partly chance. Around 1949 or 50, my former dissertation director at Harvard, a man named Howard Mumford Jones, was asked if he would edit a selection of the letters of Sherwood Anderson that had just been given to the Newbery Library in Chicago, along with a lot of manuscripts and other memorabilia. He was at Harvard in Cambridge, Massachusetts. I was teaching at Northwestern, which is just outside Chicago, so I could get to the Newbery Library very fast. And I was essentially a leg man for him. So my wife and I would go to the Newbery Library. I would read through these wretchedly written letters. Anderson's handwriting was very fast, highly idiosyncratic, readable after you've lived with it a long time, but not very clear, unless you were very used to it. So I would read these. I picked out about 500 out of the some 4,000 letters available. My poor wife typed them off, so she had the problem of transcribing them too. And then we sent 500 to Howard Jones, and among us we selected 401, I think, to publish. So having picked out the letters, learned a great deal about him for at least from 1916 to 1941, and then having to footnote the letters, identify people, find out what was happening that at a particular time, some event he was referring to, I felt that I'd learned so much about Anderson, I just couldn't throw it away. Yeah. So I decided that I would write a critical biography. There were two books that had just come out around 1950. Each was strong in some way, weak in another. I wanted to try to write a book that was strong all the way through.
You know, I met somebody the other day. She was in her 30s, and she had not heard of Sherwood Anderson, which surprised me.
Doesn't surprise me. And it doesn't hurt me either. He was, his great period of fame was in the early 1920s. Mm-hmm. But at the present time, I suppose he's less well-known, perhaps, than Thomas Wolfe, who was one of my great admirations in the 1930s, till I guess I'd say I grew up. Anderson was extremely important in developing a new kind of American short story. He didn't do it all on his own. There were other forces going on, but he was known as the person who refused to accept what he called the poison plot story. This is simply a formula kind of story. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl. He said this is not the way life works. Frequently the boy does not get the girl. Sometimes he gets the girl he shouldn't have, and so on. So Anderson was trying to write accurately about life, as he saw it, about the psychological and emotional difficulties that people had in their relationships. And he argued that a story properly told followed the contours of the event itself, that the author should not impose a form on the story from the outside, a standardized form, even though it might sell in the new, magazines. And also, he wanted to have the characters act as they humanly would, not to be forced to perform certain actions and come to certain conclusions because the author wanted them to do that. In fact, he argued that to force people to do things in a story that they wouldn't do in ordinary life, though if they were those characters, then this is as corrupt and immoral a thing to do as it would be for someone to manipulate real people and force them to do things that they should not do. And this, in fact, was one of the very few rock-bottom moral principles on which he stood.
He wrote on this theory, then.
Yes.
It isn't that he wrote stories which, in fact, followed.
I think it probably worked together, that he was dissatisfied with the kind of stories that he saw, that he read in magazines. His own life certainly was chaotic.
Because you said he was a businessman.
Yes.
He wasn't even an educated, particularly intellectual
no,
or academic
didn't,
man.
No, he didn't get through high school. And he was always a little sensitive to the fact that his spelling was somewhat erratic, that he did not have the trained intellectual resources that the average college trained person has. And so he was always of two minds of people who were highly educated. He knew, for example, Van Wyck Brooks, less well-known people like Waldo Frank, who were well-trained, college-educated people, knew aesthetics, knew philosophy, knew literature. He always felt, on the one hand, a little bit inferior to them because they had an experience that he did not have. They had a mode of training that he did not have. On the other hand, he felt that they missed certain qualities of spontaneity, of acute intuition, which he himself had and knew that he had. And in the best writing, he demonstrates. Mm-hmm. So that he was working partly out of the way he saw life. He was concerned for... he was apparently a reasonably highly sexed individual. He was frankly disturbed that most writers in the early 20th century were very reticent about discussing sexuality in their stories. If you read Anderson's stories now, they're certainly not X-rated or anything of that sort, but one can see that he's trying very hard, very honestly, to getting at the power of sexuality in people's lives and to discuss it not graphically or bluntly, but quite honestly. Well, this kind of story, the story without an expected structure, the kind of material which was often considered shocking to the older people at that time, was the kind of new writing that people after the First World War wanted to see. It seemed more honest. It was a more honest use of language. They had had language misused in terms of propaganda during the war, and this was a wonderfully fresh thing to happen. So in the early 1920s, he became quite well known as a writer of this unusual kind of short story. And for a number of years, he was probably one of the best-known writers in the country.
Well, Winesburg, Ohio was a,
yes,
was a,
yeah,
a household.
This was his most famous book. It was published in book form in 1919, though the separate stories had been, many of them had been published earlier. Interestingly enough, his probably even better work was done in the 1920s. So that the one reason for the popularity was the kind of story. The other reason was that some of the stories he wrote were just absolutely superb, and some were awful. He had some powers of self-criticism, but not always enough. So that you find that, for example, in his best book of short stories called Horses and Men, just by chance, every odd-numbered story, 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, are among the very best stories he ever wrote, and I think stand up with anyone's stories very well. The stories in between seem to me quite second-rate. I don't think he arranged it that way. It's just that it happened to be that. And so it's an uneven volume, and he was an uneven writer himself. Sometimes he wrote, as I say, superb stories, but many of the stories were not good, and he kept on writing not-so-good stories later on in his life, though some of his very good ones come from the 1930s. He wrote 8 novels. None of them is particularly good, though the best one is one called Poor White, and that is a really quite remarkable description of the emotional impact of the coming of industrialism to a small Ohio town. What happens to the people? What happens to the relationships that you find in a small village where everyone knows everyone else? And though people are nosy about everyone else, nevertheless, there's a sense of what Anderson called the invisible roof that covers everyone in a small town, and how this is simply torn apart, shredded by the coming of industrialism. And we have the development of feelings of alienation. We have class conflict, labor struggles, the perversion of the solid old values, as he would have called them, by the new get-rich-quick ethic. So he was important for that. The other thing I suppose he's perhaps best known for in terms of biography is his assertion that one day, while he was a businessman in Elyria, Ohio, he got fed up with business, deliberately faked a mild kind of emotional breakdown or slight insanity to his secretary, and told the secretary, "I'm getting out of this, I'll not come back." And his story was that he walked out of his office in the factory, down the railroad track, and out of his writing out of his business life forever. And this isn't true. It's in a sense true that he had been running a business in Elyria, Ohio from 1907 to 1912. It was a mail order business. He'd been an advertising man. He was a genius at writing the kind of mail order advertising that would con people into buying a product, usually some kind of agricultural product. He became very ashamed of himself for misusing language that way. He felt it was a form of cheating, that he was manipulating people. He'd also got very deeply in debt because he had very grandiose plans of building a huge network of mail-order firms around the country. And he was having trouble with his wife. He had 3 small children, and he never really was comfortable with children. He liked them when they grew older, and he liked them when they were small and didn't bother you, but he felt they were rather messy little critters, and he felt literally that they were hostages to fortune. So the family pressures, the probably sexually based difficulty with his really quite remarkable and supportive wife, the feelings of guilt that he had borrowed money that he was losing, all of this sent him into an emotional state. He'd already begun writing as a way of objectifying his troubles. He felt that if he could only write stories or novels about, let's say, a small man with a red mustache, whereas he was 5'8" and rather heavily built around the shoulders and strikingly handsome, but if he could objectify this into another person, then he could solve some of his problems on paper. And he had begun writing, and of course, as he wrote, he took less time with his business, And the combination of these things simply drove him into a kind of emotional breakdown for 4 days.
So he really did have that.
He did have the breakdown. Mm-hmm. And we have evidence of that. He wrote a letter to his wife, which indicates that he was under very great stress. It's been called by one scholar an amnesia letter, but it can't be an amnesia letter because it's quite clear that he's talking about his own condition at the time. In fact, it's a kind of a little short story in itself, interpreted rather loosely. Very, very curious kind of document. But he was distinctly upset, and toward the end of the period, of this 4-day period, he simply did have a mild amnesia, had to be taken care of in Cleveland. He wandered into a drugstore, could not remember his name or where he lived, and the druggist found out who he was from a notebook in his pocket and got him to a hospital. But he recovered very quickly. Then he came back to his factory for about a month. He did not return to the factory. He returned to the hometown of Elyria, then went back to Chicago. But when he went back to Chicago, he had to support himself and support the children and his wife, so he simply went back to the kind of advertising work he'd been doing before. So for another 10 years, he worked as an advertiser. He still was in business, so he hadn't walked out of it. Mm-hmm. But the real thrust of his life from then on was to write. And there's some very painful letters in the late, around 1920, 21, when it was clear that he was just getting desperate. Here he was, he felt right at the height of his writing powers, yet he had to misuse his abilities in continuing to write advertising because it was the only thing he knew. He couldn't teach, he couldn't be a hydraulic engineer, anything of that sort. So eventually he was able to get a certain amount of income from writing his stories, and he began to write not reviews but articles. And he managed to skimp along, never being very well-to-do, without the problem from 1922 on of being an advertising writer. And perhaps I should bring this together by pointing out that in the 1920s, in two or three places, particularly in The Storyteller's Story, which is a wonderful, imaginative, and quite undependable autobiography, he gave the impression that he had simply walked out, bang, one day, went from business into art, and he became a kind of mythic figure in the 1920s. Here was Sherwood Anderson, who turned his back on business and was becoming an artist. And this, of course, was terribly heady and exciting kind of stuff to the people who were young writers at the time. He became a kind of culture hero. So it was partly this, plus a kind of charismatic personality when you met him, and the new kind of story that he was writing that really seems now, when you compare it with stories written at the same time, to be wonderfully fresh and new and simple, almost to the point of simple-minded, until you realize that a great deal is going on under the surface. This sort of thing, the writing, the personality as an individual, and the myth all combined to give him this really quite high reputation. But in the by the end of the 1920s, he was not doing such good work, and a new spirit was abroad. People were more interested in sociological matters and throughout the 1930s, so that his literary stock simply went downhill. He's kept up now partly by people like me who like to teach his stories, partly by critics like Malcolm Cowley, who have commented very astutely on Anderson's work as part of the 1920s, and also a kind of underground interest in this man. It's very hard to find first editions now, partly because they've been bought up not for their value, but simply because they are the books available, by people who've suddenly lucked into reading Anderson and have decided that he helps to explain their lives, or that he's discussing alienation among factory workers, and these are factory workers who suddenly say, this guy knows what it's like to work on a machine and do the same process for 8 hours a day for 5 hours, 5 days a week.
And he, more than other writers that we might think of, even though he's writing 50 years ago, You mean understands the life of a factory worker?
Yes. Not in the sense that he often writes about factories, though he has a few stories that way. But he came from a poor family, was intensely desirous on the one hand of making a financial success as he grew up. His father was a failure, and he felt that the father had failed the family as well as in his own career. He was just terribly eager to become financially successful as a young man. At the same time, he was a kind of dreamer. Literally, he would go into daydreams as he walked along the street with his friends, and they'd have to shout at him to bring him out of his daydreams. So on the one hand, he was Jobby Anderson. That was his nickname because he took on so many jobs, one after the other, as they each job might pay better than another. So he was torn between success and a desire to dream, so to speak. I suspect at that point to dream of himself as a great figure. But later on, he saw the split was between himself as, on the one hand, the sharp con man who could write a piece of advertising that would pull money out of a snowman, and, on the other hand, a dreamer who was interested in art, was interested in other people, was interested in getting below the surface of ordinary lives. And before he got to the point where he actually began writing, he had the experience of a relatively uneducated person from a small town without a profession, without any specific goal. He had to work in factories for a while. He worked as a groom for racehorses and got three of his very best stories out of that experience. He worked in a cold storage warehouse in Chicago. He did every kind of menial job, so to speak, so that as he was, before he decided he was going to become an advertising man around 1900, he had gone through many of these hard work experiences in which he came in contact with working class people, so that he understood them, understood the way they thought, he related to them very easily, and felt that in many ways they had been overlooked in literature, not from the matter of social protest so much as a realization that they, like everyone else, tends to lead most of his or her life, or they tend to lead most of their lives, in their imaginations, as we do, because unless we are concentrated on a particular matter, our minds are turning over, we're remembering things from the past, we're imagining psychodramas, arguments with the dean or something like that, and so we build up a kind of imaginative world in which psychologically we live. At the same time, we're living in chronological time. And Anderson was very alert to this as a phenomenon in everyone's psyche, but he was also very convinced that ordinary people lived in the same way and that they were simply being scorned, that they had quite rich inner lives and that these should be written about.
Have you actually started writing on the biography?
Yes. I think probably my wife feels that it's going to take me as long to write the biography of Anderson's life as it took for him to live the life. And there are days when I feel that way myself. I started, I suppose in one sense I started when I was editing the letters, but I really didn't get going on the writing until after I'd had a Guggenheim Fellowship in 1958-59. And off and on since then, I've had moments when periods, summers perhaps, or vacation when I could put a lot of time into writing. Other times, when I was chairperson or had a heavy committee work or heavy teaching load, I simply couldn't get much writing done.
Would you normally be able to write while you're teaching, during the teaching year?
Not in any extended sense. I try to keep a day or so free if I can. I've spent more Saturdays in the Memorial Library than either I or my wife likes to think about, since it simply means that I'm gone for that day. But it's that is one of my best days for writing. I've done most of the research for the book. The research has, I suppose, been not entirely, but mostly on of two different things. One, the enormous set of letters and manuscripts and other documents that are in the Newbery Library, this marvelous private library, research library in Chicago, where the big Sherwood Anderson collection is, working with the letters on the one hand, and on the other hand, having interviews with people. I've talked with three of the wives that he had. One had died before I came along. I suppose one of the most frustrating experiences I ever had in doing my research was to be introduced to the first wife of the four wives that Sherwood Anderson had, one after the other. I hasten to add, with proper divorces in between. This was the one who had the three children, the only children he ever had. She was, I think, a remarkable person, a very liberated woman in 1904 when she married him. She was worked for women's votes. At least in 1912, she was not a feminist in the usual sense, but she was very much her own person, and she kept insisting that Anderson must develop in his own way. This became very painful when he wanted to get a divorce. She was still very deeply in love with him, remained in love with him through the rest of her life, but she said, well, Sherwood has got to develop in his own way. I've got to give him the divorce. It's the only fair thing to do, which just seems to me, well, saint-like isn't the proper word. It just seems to me terribly understanding. In her head, which is a very well-organized head, I'm convinced. I met her in her 80s, by the way, and she was still a very attractive woman. Lovely eyes, I remember, very, very soft and beautiful eyes. She must have been a very striking woman as a young person. I was asked by one of her sons, hers and Sherwood's sons, to simply come down for the evening and to meet his mother. So I came down, and before I was introduced, he got me aside and said, now, please remember that Mother doesn't really like to talk about her relationship with Sherwood to strangers. So there sat the first wife of Sherwood Anderson with all these wonderful secrets carefully tabulated in her memory. That she could have told me all kinds of stuff, and she would have been very reliable and honest and sympathetic. And I felt that under the circumstances, I simply couldn't bring this matter up. So it was a wonderfully pleasant evening. I thought she was charming, had a great time, but at the same time, I was just frantically frustrated because I never did have a chance to talk with her about her relationships with that first husband. Then the wife of this son, who was very sympathetic to what I was trying to do, said, I can't talk about the relationship between Sherwood and Mother, her mother-in-law, now, but after she dies, I'll tell you everything. Unfortunately, this wife of John, the son, died shortly thereafter. And I really felt bereft, as though a family member had died, to say nothing of a scholarly opportunity. But she was a remarkable person. The second wife, Tennessee Mitchell, was a thoroughgoing feminist. She'd been named after Tennessee Claflin, the great feminist of the 19th century. And she was very much a person in her own right. She was tall, handsome, wore clothes with real éclat, was a dance and music teacher, so she had marvelous rhythm. I've seen a number of pictures of her. She was a striking person and, again, very much an individual in her own right. And her friends tell me that the divorce from her by Sherwood came simply because she was too powerful a personality, and Sherwood felt that he was being crowded a little bit by another artist. She actually became a sculptor of some local note in Chicago, just without any training at all. So,
did she talk to you?
Unfortunately, no. She died in 1929, long before I got involved. But I did talk with the first wife. The second one died, as I say. The third wife, who was the sister of a very fine esthetician and philosopher named David Prawl. This was Elizabeth Prawl. Again, an independent woman. Anderson went for the strong-minded independent women, which I congratulate him for. He should have hung on to them longer, that's all. But at any rate, he married her, the marriage simply didn't work out. They were temperamentally quite different, at odds. And she went after the marriage, which was a very unpleasant thing for her. I mean, the divorce, which was very unpleasant for her. She went to Acapulco, to Taxco in Mexico, and helped to revive the silver industries there, along with William, his name escapes me, but he was the man who really revived the silver industries, an American who went down there to live. And she simply went down there and helped to revive native crafts as well. Then the fourth wife was a social worker, quite liberal in her political views, very emancipated. Before I go on, I ought to make a correction or an addition. For some reason, I keep forgetting the name of the man who was went to Taxco and started up the silver industries that had been so popular in the 18th century there. This was a man named William Spratling, whom Anderson had got acquainted with in New Orleans in the 1920s, and who was an architect and, in fact, designed a very beautiful stone house that Anderson built in over the beyond the Blue Ridge in Virginia, near a town called Marion. I've visited there a couple of times, three times, as a matter of fact, have been in the house. It's still kept up by the fourth Mrs. Anderson, the widow, though she lives in the town of Marion. But it's a absolutely beautiful place with out in front a croquet ground. Anderson played croquet with the most extraordinary seriousness. He hated to lose, and he loved to win. And he just played it like death. And if you went to visit him while he was living there, you had to play croquet. And you were wise not to beat him too often. So I'm told. I never met Anderson, and probably it's in some ways lucky I never did, because he would have been slightly awed at the fact that I had a PhD, but more disgusted that my life had not been more vivid and wild, shall we say, relaxed and spontaneous. And he would have filled the college professor full of the most marvelous, inaccurate stories.
You said that was one of your big troubles with the material.
Yeah. He's a storyteller. He admitted this himself. He said, when I try to tell facts, they slip away from me. When I start to tell facts, I simply lie. He couldn't help it. And I don't think that this was a pose. He couldn't care less about getting things accurate in a scholarly way. I'm supposed to get things accurate in a scholarly way, so a lot of my work has been starting off with some piece of autobiographical writing, which appears to be accurate and which has anywhere from 5% up to, say, 80% truth in it. But there's a great deal of difference between 5% truth and 80% truth, and so you have to find out what actually did happen. He can conceal facts. He can also unconsciously bring together facts from two different periods in his life. And as I say, this didn't bother him in the slightest. If the story went better told one way, he'd tell it that way, whether it was true or not. So I have to sort these things out, and it's taken a long time.
A lot of detective work, evidently.
Yeah. This is a matter of fact, is part of the fun of research for me and writing. They're, in some ways, two different operations. In research, you sometimes find yourself acting like a kind of junior FBI man, hunting up records of various kinds, trying to piece together bits of evidence, passages from letters, an obscure reference to something, let us say, a thank you, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate this, in one of Anderson's letters, turns out, when you look at it enough, to have been some money that was had been sent him by a woman admirer. And he always claimed that he never accepted money from anyone. Well, he did. This was untrue. But thank you for this has to be puzzled out. You don't know what it is, whether it's some weekend at the Ritz, which it wasn't, or whether it's a gift of something, and it turns out it was money that she was
getting. But you do have to find out.
In many cases, you simply do, because there are many things that suddenly become clear if you put facts together. I've told a number of people how, if you put all the facts together behind one of his short stories called I Want to Know Why, you get the most remarkable realization that Anderson kept up with racehorses and knew quite a bit about them, that probably in describing one racehorse, he was describing the young Man-O-War, the two-year-old who just appeared on the scene in 1919, how this particular story is told by a kind of Huck Finn character. Well, it's a young man with some education, but certain Huck Finn mannerisms of speech. Anderson gets into this because he had been talking with Van Wyck Brooks and corresponding with him about Van Wyck's book on Mark Twain, and how a black cook, a character in the story, is described as being someone you can trust. They're squarer with kids, as the expression goes. This becomes a kind of manifesto on Anderson's part that in the race riots that had occurred in Chicago in August of 1919, which he did not participate in, but which he came back to Chicago just after, the manifesto, in a sense, is saying, look, blacks are good. I would have sided with the blacks had I been here. I'd tried to prevent the riots, or I would have helped the blacks wherever I could. So that as you look at all these materials, you find that the stories come out of his experience, his attitudes, his feelings, not in a simple one-to-one relationship. He isn't a straight autobiographical writer. But you can find the pieces of experience that he's drawing on. And by finding these pieces of experience, you can find out how he feels about his life, how he felt about blacks, for example. How he felt in this particular story about the kind of disillusionment that settles in on a person when he realizes that the world is corrupt, when the artist, for example, is faced with temptations. This is a kind of masked statement, I think, in this story about the plight of the artist in a universe which is not very kindly toward the artist.
So this is why you teach a course in the novel, is to give the readers something, background of the incidents in the novels. Or what would you say? Why do you teach a course in the novel?
Oh, well,
it's fun to read them.
Well, it's fun to read them. That's one reason. And in some ways, I wonder why anyone should be paid to do something that one enjoys so much. But I do have a course which I'm teaching this semester called Anderson, Hemingway, and Faulkner. And I have only 2 weeks on Anderson, and I try to keep off the autobiographical and the biographical as much as I can. I know it's a little hard. But 2 weeks on Anderson, 4 weeks on Hemingway, and 8 weeks on Faulkner, which I think probably is an accurate kind of assessment of space on the basis of literary value, since Faulkner is clearly the best of them all. But Anderson knew Hemingway and Faulkner when they were young men, or they became acquainted for a brief period of Hemingway's and Faulkner's life with Anderson. He was at this time well known. He was famous, early 1920s. He encouraged these young men to write. And this is a very heady thing to have happen. If you're a young artist, to have a famous artist suddenly take notice of you and say, friend, you really have what it takes. Stay with it. He told Faulkner, for example, you're gifted. You're almost too gifted. You'll waste yourself trying to do too many things. What you ought to do is to go back to that little postage stamp of native soil that you know in north central Mississippi. Go back to Oxford and write about that. Faulkner took good advice. I suspect he would have anyway. Yeah. But at any rate, he felt encouraged to do this. He felt that he was doing the right thing. He went back, and out of 19 novels that Faulkner wrote, 14 are about this little postage stamp of native soil. So Anderson was of tremendous importance in terms, first, of of popularizing this new kind of story that I talked about earlier, and his direct impact on two of the major writers of the 20th century, and through these people, of course, having an impact on other writers. It's been pointed out that, for example, John Steinbeck learned a great deal from Anderson, gets some sense, probably, of how to present in literary fashion the ordinary working-class individual, which Steinbeck is very good at presenting.
You're telling me why you teach a course in the novel.
Ah, yes. I did wander off from that, didn't I? It sounds like giving a lecture. I'm sorry. I do it partly because I enjoy, I think of myself as a fiction man rather than, let's say, a poetry man. I enjoy teaching poetry and enjoy reading it, but I feel most at home in teaching fiction. I've tried writing fiction. It was pretty bad, but I have some sense of what goes on in a story, and a novel or a short story, and I like to get my students to see what, to quote Anderson, if I may, was something very important about writing. Anderson used to say, if you're going to be a writer, you've got to listen to the two voices. And what he meant by that was that when we meet someone else, we always talk in two different ways. One is the use of actual words, sometimes gestures. But underneath, there are unstated relationships going on. I like you. I don't like you. I'd like to see more of you. I'm a young professor. You're an old professor. I'm going to show you, old professor, how dumb you are. I'm going to one-up you. I'm going to describe the stuff that I've read that you haven't read, and so on. It might be hostile. It might be very nice. If you see two young people meeting for the first time and becoming interested in each other, they don't outwardly say, oh, golly, I think I'm falling in love with you. Instead, their voices warm up, and you sense that underneath there is this conversation saying, can't we get to a situation where we can say, I love you, to each other? Well, Anderson was himself very good at that in writing, and it seems to me that if you go at literature in this fashion, you learn a lot about people through the literature itself, and you understand the books very much. You understand that there is a kind of surface conversation going on in the book, but many things are just being suggested. It's not that the author has deliberately hidden them, but he doesn't want to come out too flat-footed. He wants to let the reader sense what's going on, to hunch, to intuit, rather than being told intellectually, yes, John and Susan are falling in love. He wants merely to suggest this. And I find that I get a great deal of back-and-forth, reciprocal gas engine kind of relationship between fiction and life. I think I learn a great deal about people from having read Anderson, Hemingway, and Faulkner. And I think that by teaching a subtle and intelligent reading of fiction to students, they become more subtle and intelligent in their own relationships. They become more aware of their inner lives. They're less embarrassed by being imaginative. And I don't care whether they become certified public accountants or chemists or plumbers or college professors or whatever. I think they lead richer and better inner lives. Therefore, they're more worthwhile citizens in the country. They're not so ready to have nervous breakdowns. They stay on the job. They're not ill so much because they're emotionally happier at the kind of experience that fiction can give them.
Do you have any evidence from students? Do you get any feedback?
Oh, I have the evidence that I want to have, so to speak.
You keep getting it?
From time to time, yes. It's always very pleasant. I've sometimes been bothered by the wondering how many people I have unconsciously sent to Fort Leavenworth prison by some remark I've made that they misinterpreted or that they fitted into their own lives but didn't fit as I meant it to. Don't accept everything that's told you. And it may be that this person becomes rebellious against society as a result and decides that he'll shoot up a bank or something like that. I'd like to think that I've never done that to anyone, but I always have a nagging feeling that people are, and maybe I've damaged some lives as well as made them richer and happier. I hope not. But I've taught hundreds, thousands of students, and of course, I must have damaged some along the way.
I would think quite few on the whole.
Well, I like to think not.
I think it's a funny way to end an interview.
What else do we need to talk about? How do I manage my home life? I don't know how I manage my home life. Ask my wife. She's really quite a remarkable person in herself. She works as the associate librarian in the library school of the university. She has her own profession. She has a lot of intellectual and emotional resources. She is unhappy that we can't spend more time together. simply because I go off so many Saturdays, sometimes other days, to work. Or sometimes when I'm home, I suppose I get wool gathering over something because I'm trying to think of a problem in the biography. I try to work something out. She accepts this with really more grace than I probably should have. But it's very hard to be the spouse, either the husband or the wife, or the lover, I suppose, of a person who's very much involved in writing, whether it's a novel or poetry or a biography or history, particularly if you're in biography or, let's say, fiction, because you get so into this world that you live partly there, and the outside world becomes the fictitious, the unreal world, whereas the real world is the thing that you're creating. You're imagining what Anderson would have looked like at a particular time. You'd have tried to figure out from the bits of evidence how he got acquainted with a wife and the marriage occurred and what happened to break up the marriage. You get so involved with this, it's almost like being involved with one of your children or a relative who's having marital problems. So your mind gets taken up by this, and it's hard sometimes to get back into the real life of teaching or committee work with which people in the university spend so much of their lives. It's the committee work that's the real killer, I think. It simply takes a tremendous amount of time.
And you can't wool gather in a committee.
You can't wool gather. You've got to pay attention to what's going on. The argument frequently is that at Wisconsin we're committed to death, and I sometimes think that's true. On the other hand, if the faculty won't go to committees and won't do their work on committees, then you leave it to the administration to do it, and before long they become benevolent tyrants, and then after that they simply become tyrants. And if you want to preserve faculty governance or shared governance, you simply got to put in your time on that. So between teaching and committee work and writing, and from time to time having fun at home, life gets rather busy. But I wouldn't have it otherwise. It would be terribly boring not to be busy. Even when I retire, I want to be busy.